Hi listeners, it's Lucy. Please don't scroll ahead. This is a very quick message, I promise, to ask a very easy favour. At the end of each episode, as the credits roll, you'll hear a request from us to rate and review the show. Now, for those of you that are awesome podcast listeners rather than podcast makers, you might actually have no idea what a huge difference those things make. A significant factor in the visibility of a podcast on almost all listening platforms is down to the number and quality of ratings and subscriptions. So, if you are one of our dedicated listeners, hi, I know some of you as far away as Australia, so thanks. If you're currently not driving your car or changing a baby's nappy, can you please just look down at your phone right now as I'm talking and hit subscribe and 5-star rating? Both of them are on the homepage of the show and they are both only a one-click job. But oh my God, what a lot of joy and gratitude I would feel at those one clicks. It makes such a difference to the show's potential to keep going. Now, enjoy the episode and thanks for listening.
You're about to hear a brief conversation with an incredible artist. Part autobiographical journey, part literary analysis, and part late-night chat in the theatre bar. This is Hear Me Out.
And I'm your host, Lucy Eaton. Please welcome to the stage, Sean Dooley.
So, first of all, before we even begin, Sean, we're going to let the listener know that we're very fortunately sat in the Pinter Theatre, which, as they'll realise, is quite relevant. Unfortunately, we're next to a building site.
We are next to a building site, but I think Harold would love that.
Go on.
I think that's right up his street, that. Great. Building, the noise of a building yard right next door.
Perfect.
To us talking about Pinter, I think would be right up his street.
Great.
Is my guess.
Oh, well, thanks. I needed you to say that.
I think it's like you've set it up.
Perfect, which I did. Anyway, okay, so Sean, thank you so much
for coming on the podcast.
Sean and I did a fabulous short movie together at the end of last year. Had a thoroughly good time working on that.
Brilliant, yeah.
And after only a couple of days, I was like, you need to come on my podcast.
I think it was after a few minutes.
Was it?
Lucy, if I'm honest.
Is it desperate?
Oh, by the way, I do this podcast. It's really cool. Would you come on it? Hi, I'm Lucy. Oh, hi, mate.
But I'm so glad you're on it. And we are here in the Pinter Theatre. And go on, tell us what speech you picked.
I have chosen a speech from The Caretaker to do. I think it's funny because whenever these things, can I talk about doing this first, doing the podcast? Because I struggle with nerves and I struggle with needing to prep and fear of not being able to express myself completely and all this kind of stuff. And, I'm going to segue. I'm going to go off on such tangents,
that,
mate.
I'm going to go off
left, right, and so you're going to have to keep reining me
in.
I will
get the map out when I need to, but I am happy.
But going off on a massive tangent, I've done a couple of Shane Meadows things and where you can't prep and you don't prep and there's no prep.
Right.
And he says, don't do anything, just turn up.
Oh.
And funnily enough, I found that really, really freeing in an environment where nobody's prepped and everybody is just on the same kind of, you know, motor, same engine. And I've really loved that. But as soon as you said come on this podcast, I immediately went into fear mode. And I thought it's good to talk about this kind of stuff because, you know, I think we live in a society where we tend not to show, especially with social media, where vulnerability is not shown and where everybody is just got my latest gig. Yeah, I'm just off there. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. You know, people don't post about, I've just failed to get this job.
Yeah.
By the way, I'm really quite down at the minute because I didn't get this and I really put a lot of effort into it. Mm-hmm. And so I thought maybe it's good to be honest and talk about kind of, instead of coming on being all confident and blasé and I've read a book before I come on about Pinter, to just be honest and do that, because then the younger actors that are out there, the people that are me you know, can see that actually it's not just them feeling things and that everybody else is sailing through life.
Yeah.
So I thought it'd be really good to use this as a platform to discuss that kind of thing.
So this is really interesting to me. So do you get nerves? So you obviously got nerves even in advance of this, like you say, it's like you want to be prepared.
The second you asked.
Well, thanks for doing it anyway. You're like, I have to do something every day that scares me. So this is my thing.
Well, it's one of my mottos of doing things that scare you, and it is to the kids, myself and Polly, my wife, we push that, do things that scare you. That's one of the things. If it scares you, that's where you should do it. But I think one of the major differences with like this podcast and anything to do with acting for me is that this instant feeling of, as soon as you mentioned, talk about your favourite speech, immediately sent me into this feeling of, oh, that requires somebody of a particular intelligence. It requires somebody of a particular knowledge or a particular career, having done lots of theatre and all this kind of thing. And I think what happens to a lot of people who suffer with imposter syndrome and all this kind of thing is that when we hear those words, we immediately go, that's not for me. So my instinct to you was to go, yeah, I'll do it. And then I was going to go, I'm no way am I doing that. And then I listened to quite a few episodes and I just went, they're all so eloquent and they're all so invested and connected. And I'm not talking about, I'm not saying all this so that you can get a tiny violin out or anything for me. I'm saying it so that, yeah, like I say, for anybody out there, that you go, oh God, he's done loads and he still feels like that. Because I think that's important for kids to know that.
So this level of nerves, like, do you get it? You're doing Hills of California at the moment. Is that level of nerves a thing that happens before you go into it? Or is it like a thing that you're dealing with every day before the show?
It's constant, really. It's I think you find ways of dealing with nerves. So I have routines and stuff like that and distractions from myself. But before I go on every time, I'm utterly nervous. But the difference, I think, with this, we're doing Jez's play, is that I feel this is written for my voice and for me as a person. So I don't feel an imposter in this world of the Hills of California. Whereas if this was a Shakespeare, or something else, I would feel like I shouldn't be there.
Is that sort of like ingrained thing that I think the industry's working so hard against now?
Yeah.
Because I would say it was only even 10 years ago when I remember having a conversation with an actor from up north. I can't remember exactly where he's from. And he was sort of going, I'm never going to be at the RSC. And I remember going, I'm never going to be at the Royal Court anymore, you know. And that was like 10 years ago. I feel like that has massively changed now. But I guess it's so ingrained.
It's ingrained in class from a very, very early age that things aren't for you. So, for example, when you talked about the speech, I'll tell you my favourite speech of all time is from Titus Andronicus. I won't do it.
Which one?
Because of fear. Come, Lavinia, come. Where he brings the girl out in front of the guys.
I think the Aaron one, where he says all the ways in which he wants to do, all the horrible things that he would do. I would do it as quickly as I would something a fly or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, but the thing is,
you didn't feel you could.
No, because I believe it's down to how it's taught in the first place, and these things are often, they're often taught. You know, I read Shakespeare, and many kids from, especially up north, will read Shakespeare and go, that makes sense, because quite often we still use these speak in that kind of way, and it does connect. Mm. But then you're told by academia about iambic pentameter, and you've got to hit this and that. And it becomes, I feel, especially Shakespeare, is kind of gatekept by people in a way that then means it's not for you, because this level of intelligence is added to it. So I fight against, I'm quite angry about Shakespeare and quite, you know, I pull him down quite a lot. Because what I don't like about, sorry Shakespeare fans, everybody's turning off now, podcast level's dropping like crazy. What I don't like about it is how much of a pedestal he's put on. Mm-hmm. Great writer. He also wrote some crap. And that has to be in the lump of his canon.
Yeah, yeah.
And because it's taught at school all the time, because it's taught in such a horrifically bad and boring way.
Absolutely.
You turn off. Yeah. And, you know, back when I was a kid, it was taught by putting you in front of Laurence Olivier in a pair of tights and a codpiece doing Henry V or whatever. Awful. Yeah. I mean, just awful how it's taught. And I think it's a hard thing to fight against. And what ends up happening is you reverse that and put a chip on your shoulder and go, right, I'm not going near it. Mm. No RSC, no. And interesting enough with the kind of Shakespeare and then the way it's gatekept, I think that's probably not a word, but I've made it up, but it is now.
It works.
Similar happens with Pinter in a bizarre way. Suddenly, you know, this is a guy who wrote for everyday people talking, and he was an actor, and he wrote in speech patterns. And then academia takes it and creates Pinter pauses. So you're suddenly going, I don't understand that. I don't get, Pinteresque. I don't get a Pinter pause.
Yeah.
Because it means something, because you've taken it and you've made it into this thing. In reality, it's a pause that has bits put in it, and either there's nothing to say or there's the world to say and you choose not to say it. Very simple. In all his interviews, he talks about, Pinter talks about going, if you don't connect with the pause, get rid of it. In academia and the way it's taught,
they're like, honour the pause.
Honour.
Oh, that's so interesting.
Grab that. Him himself is going, stop it. Yeah. I've performed my own work and I get rid of half of them, is a direct quote from him. And this is what I mean. I think what happens is it gets grabbed and held, and then it becomes inaccessible to other people. And it's that that annoys me. And I realised thinking about this yesterday that I'm not angry at Shakespeare. I'm angry at the way it's taught.
And I think I have that with Pinter. It's funny because I think maybe, you know, I had a private school education, so maybe unsurprisingly, I was made to feel that Shakespeare could be mine, you know. And I had some good teachers. I didn't have that with Pinter. And I've never felt that I could get through.
Wow.
And yeah, I don't know whether I felt gate kept, but I wouldn't dare to say, like, I felt like I'd been ostracised, like I couldn't get into it, but I just couldn't get into it. Yeah. And I think it's all the stuff you're saying. I kept being like, I don't get it. And the ones I've seen, again, I think Pinter is done badly a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And I've seen shows where, to your point, they're honouring the pauses so much, I just find them slow. Mm. I find them really lethargic.
And I don't know if you were taught this as well, but we were always taught at drama school that you had to earn a pause. Mm. You had to earn the right for it.
Mm.
And Jez Butterworth, who wrote Hills of California, that I'm doing here at the moment, you know, there are pauses in his work, but they're not empty. They're filled with 1,000 words.
Yeah.
And like Pinter, you know, there's a lot of time where there's no pauses whatsoever, and there's a stream of thought, stream of consciousness. And then when it hits because you're thinking, or you're stuck, or you think maybe I shouldn't go there.
Yes. And are they written into the script for Hills of California?
Oh, so the Hills of California. Pause. Yeah, there's pause, break. There's a beautiful moment in Hills of California where Brian Dick playing Dennis asks me if I miss it, and I say, miss what? And he goes, being young.
Mm.
And then it's written into the script. Pause.
Yeah.
And these two men sit there for as long as you want, as long as you can feel it.
Yeah.
There was one time I sat in it too long and forgot the next line, which was, I forgot to say. But that thing of kind of going, and it's not a dead pause. It's a pause filled with...
They're both answering that question.
And thoughts and history and life. And God, it's huge.
Yeah.
And it's... A huge moment. And I think quite often things are just, we need to just stop and just, you know, Pinter said his plays could be performed by anyone, anywhere, at any time.
It's partly a problem with the industry at the moment that I feel more than ever wants to be less imaginative, like wants to be like, well, are you the part?
Yeah.
Which I think feeds into maybe both of us having that sense with different genres of like, well, that's not for me, when actually you're like, I'm an actor. I mean, 100%. I could do anything. You could do anything.
Yeah.
But I think we have got into this cycle of being like, well, basically we're looking for the part. You're looking for the character to walk in.
Yeah.
It's interesting what you said, though, about Hills of California and Jez, and that this feels like it's written in your voice, because I think one of the things I marvel most at with Jez Butterworth, I mean, he's clearly one of the greatest writers we have living.
100%.
I mean, it's incredibly exciting to be around when he's making new work. But when you think about the last three, like, really big shows he's done, like this and The Ferryman and Jerusalem, they are such... What I can't fathom is that he manages to encapsulate, like, that... I mean, Jerusalem was, like, sort of West Country, wasn't it? And then it's Northern Ireland...
Yeah, The Ferryman.
For The Ferryman.
Yeah.
And then this is...
Blackpool.
And every time he feels like a writer who knows that place intimately.
100%. I mean, he takes a long time not to write, but between his theatre plays. And I think he's one of those rare writers that everything everybody says couldn't be said by anybody, any other character.
Brilliant.
And you can't, or so often, especially in television, you'll get a rewrite in and the name's been changed, but the dialogue hasn't.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, okay, so you're not writing for
a
person.
You care so little about actually
You are writing, this. It's just dialogue. It's about dialogue. Yeah. And I'd say the same with Pinto. I don't think you could take any of the lines and make them any of the characters, especially the caretaker. And with Jez, everything is so for that character and belongs to them completely.
Tell us more about the caretaker then.
So
for people who don't know the caretaker, first of all, can you give a brief synopsis of what the caretaker is about?
So the caretaker is a play set in one room, and it's not really. Do you know what the brilliant thing about the caretaker is? It's kind of about whatever you want to put on it. That's the amazing thing about it.
That's a very Pinter-esque answer.
You could put could put kind of anything you want to bring onto it, but essentially, it's about three guys. Two brothers, and a stranger comes into their midst, invited in by a character called Aston, who has nothing, and then starts to try and get more. I'm now questioning myself.
So is one of them the caretaker?
Basically, the caretaker is a job that is offered up to the character of Davis, who comes in, who is a tramp. I don't know if that word is still a word we use, but back then that's the word they used for him. And he comes in and then they offer him potentially the job of the caretaker of the building. The one thing that they all have in common is that they all want to do something they're not doing. They've all got a thing that they want to do, where they want to be, dreams, aspirations, and they're just not doing them. Which I could understand for some people could be frustrating.
Come on!
Just do it! Just do it! Build the bloody shed! Build the shed!
As a proactive person, I thought, I can't relate. Okay, so what is the actual speech and where in the play does the speech happen?
The speech happens at the end of Act 2, the very end of Act 2. Aston, up to this point, I need to tell you why I've chosen this speech as well. But he's one of the brothers. He's the older brother of Mike. And Davis, the tramp, has come into their space, invited in by Aston. He doesn't talk to very many people, keeps himself to himself. His dialogue has been quite short, answering questions, quite gentle, just talking. He doesn't take up much air or much space. And Davis, because of that, talks a lot. And because Aston's quite happy to sit in silence and fix a plug while sat with someone, Davis can't deal with that. So he has a little bit of verbal diarrhea quite often, and he's filling it and filling it. And I just did this. And the reason I did that is because, I mean, you were there, weren't you? You were there. You saw what happened. And it happened because he was trying to get this off me. Nothing. So anyway, so what I would do is, do you see what I mean? And what's beautiful is those pauses, you know, waiting for a response doesn't happen. So I'll fill it. And Aston's heartbeat and heart rhythm is very different to Davis's and quite lower. And this is the first time and only time he really speaks and opens up for a little bit and then closes again. And it's, I chose his speech because history music playing in the background now. I wanted to be a vet. So you told me not to say this. I was like, oh, I'll tell you why I picked this vet. And you went, no, don't tell me. Save it for the podcast.
Save it for the podcast.
So I wanted to be a vet, a big animal vet. I was obsessed. That's what I wanted to be. And I failed all my GCSEs. Basically, because I was a grade A student, and then I'd sit down for the exams, and I couldn't even pick up the pen.
Nerves,
probably neuro stuff going on.
Right.
I would then turn, look out the window, and the hour had gone, and the paper felt too heavy to turn over, and so I dropped all my grades. Dropped. It was horrific, awful. At the same time, I'm doing Barnes of Youth Theatre. On a Thursday night, just bits and bats, improvising some stuff and things like that. I'd done some amateur operatics, things like that. I didn't know what to do. The pits were shutting. My dad's, granddad's, uncles, everybody's a minor in my area. And the school are pushing me to join the army. And I'm heading off on courses over weekends. The army are trying to get me, all this kind of thing. Again, where do you push? A lad with no GCSEs, from up north, I know what, shove him in the army. Kind of attitude. But Barnes Youth Theatre, I think it might have been a theatre company called Backyard Theatre, I think. I've always been trying to find these people.
Yeah.
Had some practitioners in helping us a little bit. Anyway, I went to this session at Barnes Youth Theatre, not knowing what I'm going to do in my life. And this lady came up to me and she went, "I think you should become an actor." And I was like, "What? That's insane.
That's not a thing people
no,
do.
No, that's yeah. We don't do that from where I'm from." And she went, "I've applied and got you an audition in a BTEC performing arts course. Here is your date. Go there on Friday at 2 o'clock to audition for this BTEC. Here's a copy of this play called The Caretaker that I'd never heard of in my life. I've bookmarked the speech for you.
Yeah.
Read the play, learn this speech, go in on that day and do this speech." And I genuinely feel that that person handed me, everything I now have.
Yeah.
Including my wife and my kids, because I wouldn't have met them. So for me, that moment, giving me that speech, this young 16-year-old, and giving me that, just handed me a package and opened a door for me that was bolted shut.
Yeah.
In fact, the door wasn't even there. She chiseled out the door. Yeah,
yeah.
And built it up for me and then gave me a key to go through.
So she was at the youth theatre?
She was at the youth theatre. She was a teacher. She was teaching us, but I think she might have been from another theatre company that was brought in. I think it could be from Backyard Theatre Company. And I've been trying to find them for ages.
But so had you met her? Had she done, like, you said they brought people in to do court. Had she, like, done a couple of sessions or something?
Done a couple of sessions with us, yeah. And she just recognised something in me that I didn't recognise.
Yeah.
Probably still don't. And thought that was the career I should take. So I went home to my dad and I said, what do I do? These people think I should become an actor. They've done this for me. And my dad, the pits were shut in. And my dad just went, "You're going to be unemployed anyway. You may as well be unemployed
as
doing
an actor.
Something you like." And that's
good, though, that they
the
were
reason
so supportive,
I'm
because it can be like a...
Yeah, the Billy Elliot trope.
Yeah, a little bit. I think with a lot of people, parents could very quickly be like, "That's nonsense." Yeah. But
getting on a soapbox for a minute, Lucy, as well, that's the problem we face right now, is that if you take me then with my dad and everything, and you bring it forward to now, and I go back and I go, "I'm thinking of doing this. These people have seen something in me. What do you think I should do?" Then your parent turns around and goes, "Are you really going to leave uni with a 60, 70 grand debt around your neck into a profession that probably more than likely you're not going to work in and start your life off like that?" I think the advice given now would be, you can't
take that
risk.
Yeah,
We are now in a situation where we're going to be left going back to how it used to be, which is, lower class people not entering in the arts in any form, because that's too big a risk.
Yeah.
And we're going to lose so many amazing voices and amazing people across the arts because of that, because it is once again becoming the home for people
just
the with
people
wealth,
who can afford
to take that risk.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
people with parents who go, "I will support that risk 100%, for you."
Yeah.
You know you've got that backing.
I think what's interesting that I've heard a lot in terms of the middle class privilege as well is, like, sometimes it's not even about a parent going, "I'll pay you through drama school." It's literally just knowing if you're from a family actually where you're like, "I never consciously asked, or I never actively asked for money, but maybe I took risks in a way that
100%.
I just, without consciously thinking, well, I can fall back on my parents." I just had a sense of confidence that life would turn out okay.
Yeah.
That meant I took the risk. You know, it can be on such a base subconscious level. But then there's companies like Open Door. Do you know about Open Door?
I love Open Door. I love
David. Has been on.
I was texting
him
yesterday. Oh, has he been on?
Yeah. Brilliant. So people
brilliant.
Go back
David
to,
is doing a really, really brilliant job
absolutely
there.
Absolutely amazing.
He
and
is,
people should listen
brilliant.
To he's in the series too. And you can but Open Door is
it's
making
a great charity.
Such an difference,
yeah,
I think.
It really is.
That's incredibly moving. So did you can you remember how, like, easy you found learning the speech back then? Or, like, did it, to use a really wanky phrase, did it, like, speak to you straight away? Were you like, "I get this, I sort of get what's happening"?
It's interesting because I've obviously not revisited it at all because I've never played it.
Yeah.
And so I've not revisited
did
it
you
until.
Ever want to?
I did, yeah. Mm. I really did, yeah. But since that audition, and then bizarrely, my audition for drama school was Titus.
Oh,
so that's,
yeah,
that's why they're my two speeches in a way. But, as I was rereading it the other day, I realised as a young man the things that were important to me then in the speech, such as he talks about this beautiful thing where he goes, I know they can't do anything to me without my mother's permission, but my mum gave permission because I saw her signature. And I remember back then when I was performing it that I think I cried at that bit because I was, because that hurt me that as a 16-year-old that
your
mum would do that.
Yeah.
But no, I think it must be quite easy to learn because it's a long speech.
It's really, so you
it's
did
a really
whole
long speech.
Thing.
Did the whole speech, yeah. They must have been sat there going, what is this kid doing?
Well, they were enthralled. That's a very Sean Doody response. They weren't. They were absolutely in raptures.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit as well about, yeah, because what is the speech about? Like, he's telling a story from earlier in his life.
So, yeah, the speech is about when he was a younger man, how he was put through electric shock therapy.
Mm.
And he was in this cafe in the factory where he used to work, and he was quite open and honest about who he was as a person and things he saw. He describes them as hallucinations, and then he's not sure if they were hallucinations. And people start to talk about that and have started talking. This is all in the speech that you kind of get the backstory of, and people started talking about that kid over there is crazy, he's seeing these things, he's doing this. And so they get him sectioned. He's never, there's no mention of violence or anything like that, just somebody who potentially sees the world different.
Mm-hmm.
And he's then taken away to hospital, and it's 1960s, electric shock therapy, as we know because of the Alan Bates versus the post office that I was in,
Mm-mm.
is still being used as much, you know, to our shock.
Mm.
And he's put through that and then come out, and he's a different kid. He's somebody different who doesn't talk about things anymore. But what is interesting as well is back then I think I probably read him as feeling very sorry for himself, upset by what he's gone through. And now as an older man, I don't believe that's how the speech should be. And I believe that the speech should be quite just
matter
said.
Of fact. Yeah.
And you know how people, when amazing things, when people recount horrific things, but they've recounted it so many times, or they've gone through it so many times in their head, they don't imbue it with emotion. And I think often as actors, one of the signs of bad acting, I think, is when you imbue something with a load of emotion, as if it's the first time you've ever said it. I mean, if it is the first time you said it, fair enough.
Sure, yeah.
But
quite
often,
a tear out.
Yeah. I'm going to squeeze one out just for the just for the camera of the audience. And I think quite often people recount horror in a kind of matter-of-fact way, because that's how the only way to get through the speech.
Or they laugh through it, you know. People laugh through stuff now. They're telling an awful story.
Which is why I think documentaries are great to watch, especially as an actor. I think documentaries are brilliant to watch as an actor, because I think you learn more from a documentary, you know, or fly on the wall documentary or anything like that, than you do from watching another actor perform quite often.
Oh, yeah.
Unless it's the three, what was the Pope thing?
Two popes.
Two popes. Three popes. I was the third one. I was caught. No, I wasn't. That's
a lie.
The two popes, which I thought was a masterclass in acting. Absolute masterclass in acting. So I think that should be studied and
magnificent.
Watched.
When it's like real people. And then at the end, you're like, show us the real ones. Show us. And then they shake the picture and you're like, yay, look at the real two popes.
They were friends.
Yes.
I mean, that is absolute... That tangent.
Yeah.
That is an absolute masterclass for any actor to watch. I think
they are extraordinary. Yeah. But I might be repeating myself. So my apologies to the listener if I'm repeating myself. I remember seeing an interview with Anthony Hopkins following the two popes. It was following Westworld. And someone was sort of trying to imbue, this is to our Pinter conversation. They were trying to imbue his decisions with so much weight. And of course, Anthony Hopkins is like, I just said it. I just was trying to do it in a realistic way. I'm just making a film.
And art is so subjective.
Yes.
And it's, you know, it's even subjective in the sense that it's how you're feeling at the time. There's been films I've watched that I've loathed.
Mm.
And I know it's probably because of how I was feeling at the time.
Yes.
Had I seen it a week later, had I not read reviews, had I not... Like reviews, I mean, God, don't get me started on reviews.
What
is the point of reviews? I'm really sorry if you're a reviewer, but I find the whole notion of one person's opinion being the opinion.
Yes, being given so much weight.
So much weight is
And also, when you don't even know if they have the same taste as you.
Exactly. That's and it is thing. About taste is such yeah. a big thing.
I can't remember whether a critic actually said this to me once, but it's like a critic's job should be to find the audience.
That's a really, really great way of looking at it, isn't it? I mean, it is like music. You're not going to, like, probably if you've got my music taste, you're not going to like what's number one in the charts. But it's number one because a lot of people have bought it and are listening to it and streaming it.
Yeah, yeah.
So for me to turn around and go, that's rubbish, is really
my
wrong.
My husband does try to do that, though. He has your music taste.
Yeah.
And he'll be like, a lot I hate people. This pop. It is, yeah. And you're like, pop means popular. Like, yeah. You can't. That's literally what it means.
Literally pop.
But I love what you were saying there as well about the critic's opinion and how it can affect how you view something. Because yeah. to bring it back to the show you're doing right now, I remember Jerusalem came out yeah. when I was at drama school. And Jerusalem, I mean, I don't think it was just because I was sort of just entering the, like, London theatre scene. I think lots of people have said this since, but it was one of those shows that was, like, just the most talked about, revered show
on earth.
On earth, yeah, yeah. yeah. And I remember just hearing all this stuff about it and almost being like, what is this version of theatre that I'm... And the Mark yeah. Rylance performance, everything I'd read about it, I was like... What is this going to be like that is so superior to every other bit of acting I've ever seen in my life? Yeah. And then I went and I was like, oh, I was really disappointed. And I then went again to see it when it was redone recently and I fucking loved it. But I think it's because that first time, actually, it was like, yes, it is an outstanding play and Mark Rylance is giving an outstanding performance. It's not necessarily... in a different league to anything else you've ever seen that is also outstanding, you know? And but because I went in with that mindset, I couldn't help but be disappointed because it was
yeah,
actually just
of course.
Like,
yeah.
again, it is a one in a million, you know? Yeah, I'm not saying you see yeah. plays like that all the time, you don't. But it was basically in the same league as maybe a small handful of other things that I have loved that much. And but to have those expectations put on it,
yeah,
it was just like set up to fail.
I mean, I see the words career defining performance pretty much everywhere around London. Yes. And I feel sorry for these kids because where do you go from yeah. that? Where do you go from a career defining performance yeah. in your 20s?
Yeah.
Do you yeah. mean, you're going to go, could you not save that till yeah. I'm 60 and then yeah. do that because yeah. my career's been great.
Yeah.
I mean, the weight of that, it's funny because you're talking about, this is the first theatre job I've ever done and I haven't read the reviews and I haven't searched for them, mainly because my instinct is to search for something that says I'm bad and then dwell in that rather than anything that's good. And this is the first time I've genuinely not looked, not read. And those two or three weeks after opening night were yeah. really hard.
Yeah.
Really hard not to look.
Yeah.
Because we are creatures that
we seek validation.
Need that validation yeah. and need to, is it okay? Is it all right what I'm doing? Is it funny? Is it this? Did that bit land? Did that connect? And it's just to any actor listening to this, well, any artist at all listening to this, it was really freeing not reading them, not searching yeah. some guy in his pants still living with his mum who decides to slate you over it.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that's been a really, really positive thing for me from this job.
Yeah, I'd find that really hard.
Yeah. Don't do it. Don't.
I can remember in my very first job at drama school, it was The Duchess of Malfi and it was Jamie Lloyd directing it. And I remember him saying, I don't want anyone to read any reviews. And to be fair, I was a non-speaking role. I was so small. I was like, I'm fucking reading.
I'm reading.
Because I'm like, it's not going to say anything about me. You know, it's not going to affect my minor role. I remember even back then, they're just being like, God, I couldn't not. Do you have a specific example in your mind of something you've seen that you didn't like, and then you saw it at a different time and you liked it? A bit like me with like Jerusalem. When I saw it the second time, I was blown away. Whether that's theatre or film or something.
I don't know. If I do.
I
think it's probably more likely to be the other way when I've absolutely loved something, re-shown it to my children, and then gone,
yes.
This is actually not very good.
I know, so sad. I'm always so relieved when you re-watch something and you're like, it is as good as I remember.
Does it hold up? Does it hold up? Oh, do you know what? I tell you, this is film, not theatre, I apologise for this, but I'd always kind of loved the film Die Hard. And I took my boy to see it at the cinema and... couple of Christmases ago, and we sat there, and I'm like, please hold up. However, I would say it's probably one of the best films ever made. I think I was so shocked.
So many people listening will be like, yes!
I was so shocked by it. It's a perfect film. There isn't one scene you can pull out from that movie. Every scene is necessary.
Yeah.
You've got a hero, an anti-hero, who doesn't want to be there and does everything he possibly can to hand over the problem to other people. So the second the police get here, I'm done. Brilliant. You crack on. I'm going to have a cig. Crack on. He doesn't want to be the hero.
Yeah.
And he's pushed and pushed and pushed further into it. It is absolutely a perfect movie and shot up to easily my top five.
What year was it? Do you know?
I don't.
Because I have a theory that the golden age of cinema was the mid-80s to the mid-90s.
Ooh.
And almost, like, there's so many films where you hear it and I'm like, golden age of cinema. It's like, I think it was like a time that was a bit less cynical.
Yeah.
And I think there's just a quality to the films that were made across that decade that is so escapist, but so, like, also just, like, on the nose. I mean, my favourite film of all time, Father of the Bride, Golden Age of Cinema.
Great film.
But, like, Forrest Gump falls into the Golden Age of Cinema. Shawshank Redemption falls into the Golden Age of Cinema. Die Hard, Golden Age of Cinema. Like, you'll just start noticing it now.
They're in there.
Late 80s to early 90s.
Lucy's Golden Age of Cinema.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the next podcast.
There you go. On that note, I think we should hear the speech.
Right.
So.
See, now I'm just going to, like, bleh.
No!
Yeah.
But before we do that, let me have a little think about whether we continue with the lovely building work.
Yeah. He is.
Yeah. Nice. So just for the listener, Sean and I have been on a little excursion since we stopped. We're looking for a better part of the theatre to record in because the builders were just, they were a bit extra, they were a bit much. So now I'm going to, while Sean settles down, I'm going to paint the scene for you all. We are in the stage left box of the Pinter Theatre. Sean is tucking himself into a little corner.
It's so rock and roll.
Yeah. Okay. Right, let's pop this down like there.
It's so strange to be doing this in his theatre.
Yeah, so good.
It feels a little bit...
So good.
Yeah. So that way from there. And I'll just do it again, yeah?
Yeah, is that right?
Yeah. I used to go there quite a bit. Oh, years ago now. But I stopped. I used to like that place. Spent quite a bit of time in there. That was before I went away. Just before. I think that place had a lot to do with it. Now, they were all a good bit older than me. But they always used to listen. I thought they understood what I said. I mean, I used to talk to them. I talked too much. That was my mistake. Same in the factory. Standing there or in the breaks. I used to talk about things, and these men, they used to listen whenever I had anything to say. It was all right. Trouble was, I used to have kind of hallucinations. They weren't hallucinations, I used to get the feeling I could see things very clearly. Everything was so clear. Everything used to get very quiet. Everything got very quiet. All this quiet and this clear sight that was... Well, maybe I was wrong. Anyway, someone must have said something. I didn't know anything about it. And some kind of lie must have got around. And this lie went round. I thought people started being funny. In that cafe, the factory, I couldn't understand it. Then one day they took me to a hospital right outside London. They got me there. I didn't want to go. Anyway, I tried to get out quite a few times, but it wasn't very easy. They asked me questions in there, got me in, asked me all sorts of questions. Well, I told them when they wanted to know what my thoughts were. Then one day, this man, doctor, I suppose, the head one, he was quite a man of distinction, although I wasn't sure about that. He called me and he said, He told me I had something. He said they'd concluded their examination. That's what he said. And he showed me a pile of papers. And he said that I'd got something, some complaint. He said, he just said that. You see, you've got this thing. That's your complaint. And we've decided, he said, that in your interests, there's only one course we can take. He said, I can't exactly remember how he put it. He said, we're going to do something to your brain. He said, if we don't, you'll be in here for the rest of your life. But if we do, you stand a chance. You can go out, he said, and live like the others. What do you want to do to my brain? I said to him. But he just repeated what he'd said. Well, I wasn't a fool. I knew I was a minor. I knew he couldn't do anything to me without getting permission. I knew he had to get permission from my mother. So I wrote to her and I told her what they were trying to do. But she signed their form, you see, giving them permission. I know that because he showed me a signature when I brought it up. Well, that night I tried to escape. That night, I spent 5 hours sawing at one of the bars on the window in this ward, right throughout the dark. They used to shine a torch over the beds every half hour, so I timed it just right. And then it was nearly done, and a man had her. He had a fit right next to me, and they caught me. Anyway, about a week later, they started to come round and do this thing to the brain. We were all supposed to have it done in this ward, and they came round and did it one at a time, one a night. I was one of the last, and I could see quite clearly what they did to the others. They used to come round with these, I don't know what they were. They looked like big pincers with wires on. The wires were attached to a little machine. It was electric. They used to hold the man down, and this chief, the chief doctor, used to fit the pincers, something like earphones. He used to fit them on either side of the man's skull. There was a man holding the machine, you see, and he'd... turn it on, and the chief would just press these pincers on either side of the skull and keep them there. Then he'd take them off, they'd cover the man up, and they wouldn't touch him again until later on. Some used to put up a fight, but most of them didn't. They just lay there. Well, they were coming round to me, and the night they came, I got up and stood against the wall. They told me to get on the bed, and I knew they had to get me on the bed because if they did it while I was standing up, they might break my spine. So I stood up, and then one or two of them came for me. Well, I was younger then. I was much stronger than I am now. I was quite strong then. I laid one of them out, and I had another one round the throat, and then suddenly this chief had these pincers on my skull, and I knew he wasn't supposed to do it while I was standing up. That's why I... Anyway, he did it. So I did get out, got out of the place. But I couldn't walk very well. I don't think my spine was damaged. That was perfectly all right. The trouble was... my thoughts had become very slow. I couldn't think at all. I couldn't get my thoughts together. I could never quite get it together. The trouble was, I couldn't hear what people were saying. I couldn't look to the right or the left. I had to look straight in front of me because if I turned my head round, I couldn't keep upright. And I had these headaches. I used to sit in my room. That was when I lived with my mother and my brother. He was younger than me. And I laid everything out in order in my room, all the things I knew were mine, but I didn't die. The thing is, I should have been dead. I should have died. Anyway, I feel much better now. But I don't talk to people now. I steer clear of places like that cafe. I never go into them now. I don't talk to anyone like that. I've often thought of going back and trying to find the man who did that to me, but I want to do something first. I want to build that shed out in the garden.
Oh my God, it's so good! I'm so pleased!
Do you want to check that back? Make sure it's all right.
Oh my God, you're a star. Thank you so much.
Hear Me Out is a Lucy Eaton Productions podcast. Music composed by Tristan Kay and artwork by Rebecca Bright. Our heartfelt thanks to the estates and license holders that allow us to read our guests' speech choices. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can follow us on social media at Pod Hear Me Out and enjoy visual clips of the interviews on our YouTube channel. Finally, if you would like to support Hear Me Out, go ahead and click the Patreon link at the bottom of the episode bios.